You're listening to Sound Poetry. I am your host, David Gilmore. You're listening to Sound Poetry on Radio Tacoma, KTAH 101.9 FM. I'm your host, David Gilmore. And we are very, very honored to have a distinguished Tacoma poet, Kevin Miller, with us today, whom I've heard read myself before, but who is distinguished by many publications that received awards. His first, back in 1994, The Light That Whispers Morning from Blue Begonia Press, had a Weyerhaeuser Publication Award. He had grants from the Tacoma Arts Commission, and he has now a fourth collection called Vanish, which had the Wandering Angus Press Publication Award in 2019. So you can see here quite a few high recommendations for his collections. And he's also published in baseball anthology, Perseus Baseball Anthology 2014, called The Heart of the Order, and Spitball 75, which is also the best of the 75 issues of Spitball, which is an interesting to have baseball poems. Right? That's an oddball itself, right? But welcome to Sound Poetry, Kevin.
Thank you, David, very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
And I haven't mentioned your years of teaching, but you were a teacher for nearly 40 years.
Yes.
In the Tacoma schools. And that was in northern Washington State, in Blaine, Gig Harbor, and Olympia, and even a year away in Denmark on a Fulbright exchange back in 1991.
Yes.
When you're a young fellow still cutting your teeth on poetry, right?
I had not published a book when I went there, so I was writing the first book. Really, I wrote a lot of it in Denmark.
Well, the first book, Light That Whispers Morning, not The Light, by Blue Begonia Press. Why don't we have you begin and read some of those poems so we can get started and have some interesting commentary from you about those.
Last attempt to heal Catherine Moran. Paper rips, the heart tears, steam from the kettle smells of roses. The biscuit moon sifts light over the meadow. A fall salmon loses its silver corolla. Memories of goldfinch loop like butter beyond the fence while I trace you across China. When the petals fill this cup, I shall drink the thorns of your disease, nourish myself on changing moons, and find a light to whisper morning to your bones. And a short poem called Near Puget Sound from my second collection, Everywhere Was Far, and the title runs into the first line. Near Puget Sound, rain works for promises. Smooth stones are best for wishes. All directions point to the mountain. Umbrellas and folding chair ring diamonds. Madronas hint winter in July. No osprey keeps a secret. Dead ends run to ghosts of ferry docks. Wood-floored stores sell fishing tackle, fuses, white gas, and local corn. Black bear hunt windfall apples. Wool socks wrap ankles four seasons. School stops and starts with swallows. Wood smoke crosses, winter still crows. The seal's eyes show the way home.
Right. There you present two different styles, one in couplets and another, a series of what might be called sort of gnomic lines. They're,
yes.
Each one without punctuation, but clearly, except for one enjambment in the fishing tackle fuses series, that's the only one really that has a kind of couplet feel to it.
Right.
Yeah. And for the most part, there's not much punctuation in that last one. So you don't even bother to end the lines with a dead stop, which is interesting, I think. So, well, the first one, tell us a little bit about that. There's a lot of portent in that with a situation of illness.
Yeah, yes. My long-suffering mother, who never lived to see me publish a poem, and barely get out of high school, I guess I should say, that was written for her after she had died. She died in the 74. So that was 20 years. Well, I mean, it came out 20 years after she had died. So, but that,
yes,
you know, the death of a parent is something you deal with, you continue to deal with. So that was trying to work that out, I suppose, and indirectly as possible.
Right. And it has a kind of ritual feeling to it, as though there was a performance here of ritual. Is your mother from England, from Europe?
No, she's one off the boat from Ireland.
Okay, Ireland. Well, Europe, yes.
Yeah.
The steam from the kettle, smelling of roses, for example, the kettle, the biscuit moon, things like that, implied a kind of British element was at work in it. So I thought perhaps it was a relative or a friend who was from another country, and
right.
The petals, eventually the rose. Roses of the smell of the steam in a kettle become petals filling a cup that I shall drink the thorns of your disease. You carry that down there and you nourish yourself. So there's this idea definitely of feeding or nourishing yourself through a ritual occasion. Is that right?
I would think that would work.
Uh-huh. And yet that's also the light to whisper morning to your bones is where you have your title from, too. A slight
right.
variation on it, though. So when we go to Near Puget Sound, which is from another collection, of course, your mind's in a different place.
Right.
And you live in Tacoma.
Yes, I do live in Tacoma. In fact, portion of this poem is in the concrete down at the promenade. They set poems down at Point Defiance there looking over at Vashon Island. Part of this
yeah.
poem, although it's weathered completely, almost gone, is in that promenade series
yeah.
of poems down there.
Any poet particularly come to mind in the form of this one, or in the way those statements seem to be like words of wisdom? Or,
well, you know, Merwin never used punctuation, but certainly he managed to let the language work without the punctuation so beautifully that. I would be hard pressed not to pay homage to him, at least.
The abstract idea is left up to the listener to make what they want of that. You really worked that one into a kind of musical composition besides, right?
If successful, yes.
Right, it is.
Out by Horsehead Bay that had a baseball field right at the intersection, and little kids would play baseball there. And so parents would sit around with umbrellas, and, you know, of course, diamond is baseball diamond. So, I mean, that's an image. So, but you know, diamond is always a great word because it goes a couple ways. Yes.
But at first I had no idea that we're talking about baseball diamonds, but I did think of tiles or flagstones. And the umbrella, you know, the umbrellas and stuff.
Students ask the greatest questions, and students, once comfortable, seem to feel very confident about telling you what they don't get. And I think that was why I enjoyed teaching poetry to students so much, because we could talk together, and there's the realm of possibilities, and students brought so much to the table. So it was always enjoyable that way. And they were never afraid. The ones I had were not afraid to say what they didn't get, and not afraid to be a little bit upset if they felt somebody was just being abstract to be abstract, which I don't think any of us like, you know. So,
right.
They were able to, as they say, call BS when they felt it. So I like that about students too. So
I wonder when poets read, if it isn't often best thing to have each poem read, and maybe all the poets go and read and then say, okay, now we're going to start again and everybody's going to read again, just so that you can capture a little bit more.
Yeah, it was a great film I used to use in teaching, and it featured Robert Bly. And Robert Bly he would specifically do that. He would read a poem, and this is at a reading. He would read a poem, he would let it settle, and then he would read the poem again. And it was a wonderful, wonderful technique. And one time in the year is not enough. It helps.
Right. So we do need to listen very carefully to poetry, but still, it seems to be a passing fantasy. Here's something I think that alerts people to a serious situation in your poem, The Anniversary. You could read Anniversary and Vanish.
Anniversary, 4+ change. I have loved you in dog years, followed you through dog-eared pages of fiction, hesitated where I imagine you stopped. I wonder if the line where the field out the window turns to flame is where you drifted from the page, and if in pausing you saw the stable in France and us at the window when lightning struck the pasture. You spent the night on the hall floor, propped like a woman reading in bed. You hated the horses kicking the stalls. We talked through the night until fear lay on its side like a shoe blown apart. And then Vanish, again, the title runs into the first line. Vanish whispers its swish of sound as a trail of breath follows an image you hold like the title of the film you saw 2 nights ago. No longer on the tip of anything. No aftertaste. No crumbs to help find your way back to a place you forget being. This little tremor of fear when the ripples left by the stone fail to reach the edge, and the pond is a space as dark as the swallows you remember returning to the nook above the door in the garage behind the house you find only in your sleep.
Those two, again, are somewhat linked, it seems to me, by experience of perhaps the first one, something of horror, something of terror, and the second one with a trauma or some sort of vanishing of what kind is what a person thinks. What, because you don't say exactly what it is, because you don't want to say, leave it to the thought, the imagination, right? This is from a real experience, I imagine, but whether or not you fictionalized or imagined the situation, it's a great idea to make a poem have a transposition. It goes from one frame of mind to another.
I've been married for, 52 years in June. So, you know, the old joke is for the anniversary, oh, good, another poem, you know. It reminds me of the day I bought a vacuum cleaner on Valentine's Day and the checker at Costco said, don't go home with that. So
wait
anyway, it's an anniversary poem, but I mean, you know, it's a love poem, and it does come from partially from an event. Yes. So,
and so you did go to France and have an experience where there was some danger there.
Yeah, actually, yes, it did. Yes.
A frightening night.
Yeah, I'm not a big fan of lightning. Maybe because of my Catholic upbringing.
And we'll get to luck and coincidence in a while, right? So the second one then, the swish of sound and the things that are no longer on the tip of anything, and no crumbs to help you find your way back to a place. There's something changing in a person's awareness of the coordinates of where one is.
Yeah.
You love birds, I can see, from several of your poems. You're very much a bird watcher, right? Goldfinch that come in and swallows, school starts and ends with them.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And so the places that you find only in your sleep is an interesting way to end that one. I thought of that quite a bit because I'm having some sleepless nights. But when I do sleep, there are dreams. And I don't know where I go sometimes, but there are places behind our houses that I find only in the sleep. So yeah, poetry can stimulate person's thinking and imagining for a lot longer than the poet might imagine. Did you ever talk about how poems are to bring things to life that are dull and dead?
Yeah. In its best sense, for me, to hear a good poem opens me to stories of my own. So when I go to a poetry reading and I hear someone else, first I appreciate the poem, but then I have to say a good poem will trigger memories that I have of my own places that may have started with hearing the poem. But yeah, so I think ultimately that poetry can do that for us. It can connect us to those parts that sometimes we forgot we were even present to.
Oh, sure. Because the way the image takes on some vividness, and then you seem to insert yourself in it and act.
Yeah.
As if it's a fiction that you have just begun to launch into. Yeah, right. You're going back into your early school days here.
Yes.
And your name is on the board.
One, I was a terrible student. And yes, I was more likely to have my name on the board than anywhere else. I loved handwritten letters. And I had the nuns, and they had this beautiful penmanship. So part of that is in this poem. So I'll just read it. Your name on the board. The cursive leans into wind as if a breeze cushions the slant. Sister writes your letters board left, and you relish the way it starts with her swirling capital K, the one you practice and use for years without attribution. To ensure longevity, you earn two checks. Negative attention has legs, and you want to practice all five letters before they disappear. Infamy trumps compliance. See Dick and Jane run amok. Your foray lasts until the note home. Her method, pure Palmer, streams like spun glass, chronicles sins venial until your father deems them mortal. This one man legion of decency whose own hand-cut, strong, elegant letters you keep bound and safe in your desk drawer.
Yes. So that tells us a little bit about incidents in your school life and going home to have other retribution.
Yeah. Yes.
Right. It's memorable, I think, for a lot of people, those times of infamy or being a notorious rascal in school. You want attention. That certainly points out how you got yours. So early winter now, these are old town poems, early winter in the old town.
Right. That's, and I used to live right up there on McCarver looking out at Vashon, and we lived there for about 20 some years. So I think this is actually in Vanish. I wrote a collection of poems when I lived in Old Town. So, and so it's a lovely part of town. Early winter, Old Town. The spurtle lists in the porridge as if the fiber coalesced and rose to flag this territory for hearts strong enough for winter. The cold's given itself to the fog. Together they spider like wedding veils on abandoned lavender. Stems of uncut peony and humps of heather lining the walk to the birdbath. The foghorns drone off Vashon Island. They owe it to the trains and their arrogant way with time. The neighbor's fiberglass greenhouse is neither green nor house, though it glows in the morning dark like a church big enough for a small god and you.
Largely imagery, but the poet is presenting that for listeners to enter it, right?
Right.
And we who live here, of course, are quite familiar with some of those, so they ring true. There is not a lot to boggle the mind there, as there was in the more abstract poem that you read earlier. This one comes through with very clearly defined, delineated imagery, and memorable for people that go through those seasons. Here we have three poems together. They're not necessarily connected together, except by belonging in a section called Smoke and Miracles.
Right.
From Vanish. And so you have a whole section, but you're going to read three of these poems for us.
Right. And just a little background on the poem. It's an entire section of the book. So it's 23 or 4 pages long. The big title is Smoke and Miracles, and then these little sections underneath have their own little titles. The one thing I should say about this is I have a goddaughter, nearly 40 years old, and when she was 20, she was in a serious traffic accident, and she survived and is living again, although she died 3 times on the way to the hospital after the accident. I'm pretty careful about this relationship, and she recovered enough, and she got married. And so one day I always answer anything she asks. So she said, tell me about marriage, because she had just been married. And it's not something I feel I've been there a long time, but, you know, I speak English. People don't ask me to tell me about English. You know, I've been married. I'm not an expert, I guess is the only thing I'll say. I started writing this poem to her in answer to her question. So these are all little bits, and they're all in answer to the question, tell me about marriage. It's like feeding horses in a snowstorm. The sky descends like a veil and conceals pastures an acre at a time. The order that is fence lines disappears in the marriage of earth and sky as the two of you dish the flakes, collars up, heads down, and what doesn't vanish is the idea of the horses and each other, silent within the whistling quiet of storm. This is work, whether you see it or not.
Good. And foraging in the fog and the snowstorm.
Spoken like a married man there, David.
It's like feeding horses in the snowstorm. That's a great line.
Luck. Coincidence and chance are magic dressed in Levi's and a t-shirt. Accident's gauzy image stumbles like a man in heels. Energy tinkles like Sedona wind chimes. Destiny is Calvin without Hobbes. Fate strikes you as too Greek or Roman. It's like choosing Eros over Cupid because Cupid sounds, well, you know, picture your mother dating online. Luck strikes home. It's the wrong numbers, perfect smoke ring around what becomes your life. Okay, one more in that line. This one, it's like weather. 60 days without rain, the leaves fall from heat, the colors fail fast. As if too soon the surrender, loss without regret. You miss rain like some miss breakfast or a cigarette. What it is, day after day, sameness, until you want to scream, and you know no one's at fault. Still, fault settles it, allows blame, and blame feels good like a shot of vengeance. It bruises in ways the fall colors come alive under the skin. Again, a fall, a parting, a loss you forget with the first storm, when a fire, tea, and a blanket find you together, cozy enough for a change, though too long under a relentless sky becomes its other side, and you long for the same sun, forgetting where fault lay. Nevertheless, fault sends you to your corners until first snow or spring thaw turns you to each other. And when this happens, you turn blame to praise, overdue gratitude. For if you made the dark, you must give the light. If you kept the rain, you might have brought the sun. And since no god sleeps next to you in these beds, you share no blame. Make praise your daily bread.
Yes, again, to the question, what's marriage? Yeah. And so you get the feeling of various moods and feelings of dismay, taking on blames and harboring them. There's some sort of lesson in marriage for anybody that wants to read your poems in Vanish, right?
Vanish, right, the last section.
Very good. Now we're going on to Spring Meditation, which is a recent publication from Moonpath Press. Right. And you call it a collection of baseball poems.
Looking out this window, thinking of Ernie Banks and William Carlos Williams. The broken-handled wheelbarrow leans into its third spring, propped like a knothole kid against the side fence. The games go on. Those of us benched because of age understand quiet is like a rainout. We pause to rebuild tired arms, recover from losses, slumps, errors. We have time to turn this thing around, rally. The rookies are immortal. They laugh and tip their caps from the end of the bench, understanding parts ritual and superstition. We never pack the bats till the last out.
So when did you get interested in this baseball so much that you felt that you could put it into your poems like this?
Well, baseball was before poems. You know, I got to college because of baseball. Because I played baseball, I was able to go to school. It was a ticket in, and then I sort of owe baseball. So it was a pretty consuming part of my life for a long time.
Mm-hmm. So, we go on now with a biking poem.
Okay, this is called Bike Path. And it's written for a friend of mine who was my first publisher, Jim Bodine. Bike Path. Riding the red bicycle, you wear headphones. You ride double with Bessie Smith. Warm tones, summer heat. Behind you, North Dakota stories where cream and peaches are sacramental. A peach's paper wrap makes a sound fit for worship, and you carry the devotion to the coast and part way back. Vonnegut might have warned Lot's wife about trains. Prine sang about the altar boy and the local commuter, and Satchel added, never. The Vanish warn us about looking back. Maybe it was the old ruse, don't think of elephant. Keep the backstory as a charm. Keep it on an altar with photos and handwritten notes. Be evocative when you explain, this is my mother in Manila, my great-grandmother who tended bar in Butte. The Empress of Blues propels the red bike. You ride the circle, telegraph where you will be.
A person with headphones riding a bike, we're accustomed to that now. Here you have some references to Kurt Vonnegut and Prine the singer,
right,
and Satchel Paige, I imagine.
Yes.
What does Satchel say with his never?
He said, never look back because somebody might be catching up to you.
Okay. Exactly. Poetry is good at hiding things.
Well said, well said.
Not like ospreys.
That's right.
We have Sunsets and Night Owls, which is another recent one. You told me before that you have a place up in Whidbey Island, right?
We've moved to a place outside of Coopville. The only reference here I think I should mention is Navin R. Johnson, and that's the name of the character in the Steve Martin film who runs down the street screaming, "The new phone book's here, the new phone book's here." So, sunsets okay. and night owls. The new garbage can arrives like a Navin R. Johnson phone book, and I send friends photos to verify new digs. Signs make it so. This one's sleek green and two-tone. It arrives with a praying mantis riding the flip lid, maybe an omen. And though I find portraits of restaurant food gauche, I am serious about waste. This wheelie bin says we have taken the show north of the fires to an island. The onshore fog blankets a kelp bed. The night owls are owls. Sunsets over the Olympics North End are so close. Canada is possible, and given pending elections and our rowboat stashed at the road's end.
How modern that thought is. you may need to escape America. Well, from there, nicknames.
Right, like the stories of the neighborhood. Nicknames. The way I remember it, Tommy S. came into his own that day after years of abuse. The way the garage doors gave when we pushed one side and pulled the other. Sliver did the sideways turn, the one we said he should do to disappear. He made it inside to unhook the latch on the back window. This, a good start to what went south really fast. We had no time to applaud, no real credit given before the back porch screen door squealed its warning from up at the house. Sliver crossed the garage, neared the window. He never heard. We dropped everything and ran. "Hey, guys," was the last we heard from Tommy, who never managed the getting out. Old Herman must have had the shotgun near the door. The first report echoed before we made it under the laurel hedge that ran the length of the alley. It wasn't so much the blast. The glass and muttons made a fiberglass whoosh. Without us propping the doors, the back window was his only out. We scattered like birdshot. No one ever called Tommy Sliver after that. And years later, when I saw him at his mom's funeral, he'd gone doughy. Epp said, most nights Tommy sat at the bar at Targy's nursing schooners, said he always sat on the stool facing the street like he was waiting for someone he knew to walk through the door.
Wow. Yes. A narrative poem like that is unusual in your poetry, is it, in the repertoire?
Well, I have a few here and there. I mean, I like to use it, but I don't. They come unplanned.
So how old were you about when you were a rascal like this?
That was probably 14, 15 years old.
Oh, boy. You were getting into some trouble then.
We were.
Yeah. What a scamp you had to have been. But then we got a feeling for that in your school days too, where your name was constantly on the board. All right, so that's wonderful. That's a great variety. Thank you for giving us such a miscellany of styles and types of poetry. The one series of verses called response to Casey Fuller's essay, Ending the Poems. Tell us a little bit about the origin of it, Sue, because this Casey Fuller is important here.
He's a lad that I used to correspond with. We sent postcards back and forth with poems on them for 10 years, and he's moved away and disappeared on me. But before he left, he wrote an essay called Ending the Poems. I took the essay, and I took a series of lines that struck me, and then for each line of his, I wrote a response to that. So that's where this came from.
So why don't you read until you feel like taking a pause to explain something?
Response to Casey Fuller's essay, Ending the Poems. Was wonder less accessible? The forsythia in fog is cousin to one in sun. Cousins from an angle turn twin and echo. Sounds change in fog, and yellow is one of the colors the dog sees. An old dog returns to familiar haunts, circles, settles in a way that is not surrender. What rain says to the short show of blossom is enough promise for now. Less and less. In the wooden wine box where no wine lives, stacked postcards record small excursions. The wonder of mail travel bears the shadow of closed metal boxes, leather bags, and weather. On a good day, the carrier might stop, sit on a step, sip water, and read lines exchange cross country. Who continues to volley these short tosses? Why? Did I try? Every day I face the keys with one notion. I have the inside shot at most improved. I tell my grandson two things. 5 years from now, this will mean nothing, and no one can make you quit. Did people stop reading? When wild forsythia appeared through the laurel, I remembered banks of votives the Polish woman set alight each morning before Mass. She mouthed prayers through missing teeth, flecks of spit, and the odd syllable appeared as we watched in wonder. She wore a scarf knotted beneath her chin, wrapped her thick fingers in a rosary. Once a boy played in church, she grabbed his ear, lifted him to his feet, and moved him to her pew. When people stop reading, she will not have been. Was the page pure white somehow? You made white the loss of blood in the face of the boy watching Benny Kid Perrette fall to the canvas. Fights on the box stay in black and white, and father's stories line like pulp fiction for boys eager to know when white made the background square for the lucky strike red heart and smoke clouds delivered the spoken word. The dragons in our lives were all about fire. Did I repeat, I can no longer, I can no longer? Craig McNeely had mediocre speed, a decent curve, and a dry ice will to win. At bat, he crowded the plate, fouled off as many pitches as he could until he topped a slow ground ball. Unless there were men on base. With men on, his chop followed a step back in order to strike leather, the certainty of interference, his money stroke. Sometimes the way through is around. Did I feel lost? My friend who carried the mail in the Republic of Portland mapped the city in faces, screen doors, filtered lives in excessive heat. He had a heart for the feral cat, a stolen bike, a postcard in need of a good reading. When I lose my sense of direction, his shoe miles make the circuit on hot pavement. A bottle of water means something. The woman behind the curtain knows he will find her home. Could I still hear the honey, the clouds parting at the start of a first line? To trick myself into forgetting 100 failures, I start with what is. Say this robin in the bird bath. Say bare fir boughs. Say the mold on the gate leading to the green belt. Recognize no bees, no honey. Wait for buses. Wait for the bell. Wait for the question I cannot answer to make the first line. Because I no longer hand-stitch my journals. I first saw a thimble playing Monopoly. Later, on the flat top of my grandmother's foot treadle machine days, when sewing was clothes, not bookbindings, needles and the eye were the rich getting theirs. The suture's scar keeps in mind the hand-stitched tie of work to work. Did the time seem ready for a long thoughts, deliberation, prose? On this side of the grass, lines lean the same way, in stop or meandering, run on, verbs, the sound and flurry of provisions kept dry and close, secret systems for collating broken promises, close to wishes held after the last candle refuses to smoke. Could I see suddenly that much of my life had been a pulling away to write poems? The road to the Folsom Lighthouse is an asphalt run under the canopy of deciduous trees. I return to the small tower, the black fenders of my bike rattle, the bag of small potatoes purchased with pocket kroner remind me this is not the last stop. 26 years later, I write the scene that plays in my head. At the shore near the point, I face the ocean at the end of my world. The Kattegat Sea reaches toward the dead, the nether place of grandparents, parents, uncles, and lost friends. Away smells of salt and dried seaweed. It is a misaddressed postcard, Bartleby's dead letter office, a one-man game of catch. Was the beautiful interplay that mesh essentially over? It ain't over till it's over, said the great number eight. Roy Orbison took a poke at it too. Fat lady comes to mind. Still, when my friend's wife found a lover at the community theater, well, sometimes it is. We have to walk away. For years, I worked to end things, clean, hammer, stroke, drive to finish. It was obsession. A person who must have the final word until someone showed me an open door. A line with no bullet hole, no Katie bar the door, in line and cloud.
Excellent.
Thanks.
I think anyone who has just heard a long series of poems by Kevin Miller has the chance to back it up a little bit and hear those a second time just to catch the drift. And in that one poem, the penultimate poem, you have references to your Denmark trip.
Right.
Way back 30 years ago.
Exactly, 1990.
Yeah. So you've really incorporated a good bit of your experience, even up to date, going back in memory and pulling out imagery that was significant then and brings out some good lines for memorializing, for making it indelible. Well, I thank you very, very much, Kevin. It was wonderful to hear you read. I think there are so many lines there that people should pick up on. And if you follow Kevin's pattern, maybe take one of Kevin's lines and go with it yourself, which is what a lot of poets do.
That would be the best result for me right there.
The way to steal well. But you didn't steal too much, Kevin. It was wonderful to have you. And thanks so much for participating with Sound Poetry.
David, thank you. It's been a pleasure. And thank you for your keen readership. I really appreciate this conversation.
I'm David Gilmore, the host for Sound Poetry.